Thanks for tuning into Radio Times. I'm Katie Meyer, in for Marty Moscowane, and today we are talking about student debt. The amount of student debt that Americans are saddled with is rising quickly, and President Biden has been under a lot of pressure to do something about it. He's always been hesitant to cancel student debt, but he recently said he's willing to get rid of $10,000 in student loans. Now, many experts and progressive politicians say he needs to go bigger. Joining us to start the show is one of those politicians, Philadelphia Councilmember at Large, Kendra Brooks. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So you introduced a resolution last month, an interesting resolution, calling on President Biden to cancel all student loan debt in his first 100 days in office. Now, as I said, he's already said he's willing to cancel some debt. Other, you know, lawmakers have urged him to go higher. But, you know, why are you calling for all debt to be canceled?
Because what we know, the reason we call for this resolution is because, you know, we have an unprecedented pandemic happen. So many folks were already cost-burdened with student debt, and that's the opportunity for us to rise above this current crisis is important. Mm-hmm. And it's important that he cancels the student debt because we need to make sure that we're giving, you know, people a fair shot at, you know, at life as we begin having this conversation. Including with myself, I have student debt, my daughters have student debt, and just the opportunity for folks to bounce back is difficult when you have an unprecedented amount of student debt. And then we see it primarily focused in Black and brown communities. Mm-hmm. You know, we offer this idea, this concept of the American dream. You push your kids to go to college and get an education, and then we find too often that people aren't able to even get good paying jobs to be able to not only, you know, pay back the student debt, but to begin life. So it's important that, you know, we push the federal government to do all that they can to make sure that our, you know, next generation of folks and our economy bounces back.
Mm-hmm. And in Philly specifically, I want to ask about this because Philadelphia actually, about a quarter of the residents here have student debt. That's higher than average. Do you think it's especially important in a place like Philadelphia, and why might that be?
Well, you know, when you think about student debt here in Philadelphia, and so many people have it, you know, we realize that the job market has been pretty stagnant. We ask people to go to college for low-paying jobs, right? Even to get a low-paying job, you need a college degree. And once again, the only way for us to get our economy back here is to allow people the opportunity, you know, to start life debt-free or close to debt-free. And with the amount of debt that folks have in Compass here in Philadelphia, it's going to make it extremely hard, especially since the cost of living is increasingly rising. And we see so many folks already cost-burdened around issues, basic needs like housing. Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure that we give people the opportunity to start anew.
You mentioned
this is a perfect opportunity to do so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned your own experience with student debt, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that. You know, how and people who you've spoken with, you know, in Philadelphia over the course of your work. I'm curious, just like, what are the ways that you hear about this affecting people's lives, just day to day?
Well, you know, I know several people that have, you know, student debt just is one of the highest bills that they need to pay. Mm-hmm. And then they have jobs that aren't even meeting the needs. And I can tell my own personal story.
Sure.
I have an MBA in management that I got later on in life. When it was time for my daughter to go to school, I had, you know, was able to take out some loans, but not the MAC loans because I had so much student debt of my own. And then when I lost my job, she had to leave school. So then she amounted student debt for the loans that I couldn't get, plus my loans. So that put me in a position that I'm helping her pay back her loan. I have my student loan, and then I have another child that went to school, and now she has student loans. So if you think about the amount of generational debt that's built on student loans, it's unfeasible. And I have two other children that are preparing for college age as well. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of giving people the opportunity to build generational wealth, we have debt on top of debt, which prevents, you know, generations of families from getting ahead. Mm-hmm. And it's not just my story. I know several folks that they have student loans. Their children have student loans. Both parents have student loans. And the student loan repayments that have been currently offered, you know, are still very high. $600 to $800 a month to pay back a student loan is a lot of money when folks are already struggling to put, you know, to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm.
Especially
mm-hmm.
when we're talking about folks that just got, you know, just were able to obtain, you know, low paying jobs. And I'm talking about if you have $100,000 in loans and you have a job that's paying $40,000 a year, that's not going far.
And now I do want to talk about, you know, what we're hearing on the national level about this. So President Biden has said, I'm willing to go to $10,000 loan forgiveness. He has argued that he shouldn't cancel more debt than that because, you know, most borrowers have under $10,000. The ones who have more tend to be a little wealthier sometimes. And he thinks, or he has said, that it would canceling more would disproportionately help wealthier people who borrowed more money to attend more expensive schools. Now, this is an argument we've heard kind of a lot. And I think this is something that you've pushed back on specifically. So what, you know, what do you think when you hear an argument like that?
Well, what I know is that I know several people that aren't wealthy that still have student loans. So that I think that's a false narrative. And the reality is that, you know, until $10,000 is like a dent. You know, for my student loans, there's only a small portion of it. $10,000 is only going to really clear people's interest, because we're talking about the debt. We're not talking about the interest. And we realize that the federal government didn't have a problem with bailing out Wall Street. So I don't understand why we wouldn't be open to bailing out taxpayers, like our own American citizens that are trying to bounce back. So, yeah, I definitely push back against that narrative. And most of the wealthy people that he's talking about, they probably can afford to pay back their student loans. We're talking about the large amount of people in Philadelphia and other cities like Philadelphia that have accumulated student debt and just need a fair share, and it needs a fair shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, again, when we talk about this, you know, we hear these numbers thrown out. Biden has said 10,000. You know, the House lawmakers have said maybe they're willing to go to 50,000. Some progressive senators like Elizabeth Warren have said 50,000 is a good number. But what you're proposing is a little bit more sweeping. And I'm wondering, you know, is this part of a different vision of what higher education should be?
Well, I do believe in education for all and free education. But, you know, I also come from an organizing background. So we're gonna start where we want to be, which is eliminating all student debt. The mm-hmm. negotiations can come later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and then once student debt is eliminated, though, I mean, and obviously, you know, you're on the city level. These are going to be conversations that happen at high levels of government. But I'm curious what you think. You know, once debt is eliminated, the system is still the same. And I've heard it argued that this would just, you know, wouldn't de-incentivize schools from charging, you know, large amounts of money and getting kids to take out loans to repay that debt. And I'm wondering, you know, are there longer term reforms that you would support making or that you've heard about that you feel are promising?
I've heard several pieces of reform. When we talk about, you know, offering free tuition at state colleges, I've heard offering opportunities for folks to be able to, state colleges, free community colleges mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. Basically just making it more accessible, you know, sort of at the bottom line and not yeah. making it necessary to take on so much debt. And on that note, I mean, you mentioned this concept before that I think is interesting, that, you know, people go to college in large part in an attempt to create generational wealth, to get higher paying jobs. But sometimes what they end up with, what you say you've ended up with, is just generational debt. And you mentioned that this disproportionately affects Black families. And I'm wondering, you know, what are the factors that you see going into that? Why do you think Black families, Black people, Black students are more affected by this? What are the factors there?
Well, what we know is a large number of folks are first generation college. They're already coming from families that were already cost burdened. And then the opportunity for a higher education became just that, an opportunity. And not understanding how student loan debt works, not really understanding how the financial aid system works, and all of those things. It's not something that's taught in school. It's not something that someone else has gotten their way. It's the opportunity. Most parents look at it as the opportunity for their children to get further. Mm-hmm. And not realizing, like, taking on these large amount of debt will come and affect them, you know, later on in life. And not just the debt, it's the interest system on it over time. And I think it's just a lack of understanding on how this whole system works, and then not having, you know, somebody to help pay for tuition, like parent plus loans. If you're already coming from a low income family, you're not going to qualify for certain loans, and we have to push our children towards grants and scholarships. And, you know, sometimes those aren't easy to come by. So, and it's not enough to go around. Mm-hmm. The reality is that they end up in this perpetual system when the goal is to get out of poverty. And what it ends up doing is just building more debt.
And do you feel that that's, you know, again, that that's happened to people that you know, that that's happened to you, that this was this dream of, okay, yeah, let's improve life, let's make life better, and it's become a burden?
Yeah, I mean, even I'm the first college grad in my family. My siblings went on to college later on, but I am the oldest and the first college graduate in my family. Yeah. So the opportunity for someone to help me pay back that or to even take on any of my debt was unheard of. So it became a responsibility of my own.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that I'm not the only one with that same story.
Mm-hmm. And just a minute left here, but when you hear, you know, Joe Biden throwing out that $10,000, I mean, do you think that this is a step in the right direction? Or is this something where you're like, oh, we have sort of a long way to go in this conversation?
I think we have a long way to go in this conversation. A step in the right direction, of course, but we still have a long way to go.
Yeah, yeah. And from, you know, the Philadelphia level, you know, in the months and days ahead, obviously you've passed this resolution, you know, letting, you know, the federal government know where you stand. What comes next? What more can the city do?
Well, this piece of resolution was supported by a large number of my council colleagues, and we'll continue to find ways to make sure that the next generation of college students from Philadelphia have a fair chance on what it means to get ahead. If we're the poorest largest city in this country, we need to find a way to help folks build wealth and come out of poverty. And we understand that education, or even some level of continuing education, even if it isn't a college degree, is a pathway. And we need to continue to build what it means to be middle class here in Philadelphia. And that's offering wider amount of job opportunities, whether it's through higher education or other ways.
Mm-hmm. And from what you're hearing, do you think that, you know, there's progress being made, again, on the federal level? Are you hopeful?
I mean, we have no choice but to be hopeful, and we have to continue to push. So it's my job as an elected official to continue to push on every level to make sure that we're offering opportunities for all right.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for talking today. We will be back in a minute. That was Philadelphia Councilmember at Large Kendra Brooks. I'm Katie Meyer in for Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the show. I'm Katie Meyer in for Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about student debt this hour, and I want to say we welcome your stories about your own student debt, your questions you have about this very, very big topic. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. Or you can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. On Twitter, we are WHYY Radio Times. Now, with me for this section of the show are two people who have spent a lot of time thinking about what to do with student debt. We have Jalil Mustafa Bishop. He's a scholar and researcher at the University of Pennsylvania who looks at the uneven economic and racial costs of higher education for Black people. Jalil, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course. And we also have Seth Frotman. He's the executive director of the nonprofit Student Borrower Protection Center. And before that, he was the assistant director and the student loan ombudsman for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Seth, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Of course. Thanks so much, guys, for coming. And Seth, I get just to get the lay of the land here. I would like to start with you. We mentioned that, you know, here in Philadelphia, more people than average have student debt. And just across the country, I want to remind people of the scale we're dealing with. Seth, so how much student debt is there?
So, you know, you heard from the councilwoman the what's happening on the ground in Philadelphia. And unfortunately, that is replicated in big cities and small towns throughout America. I think what you see is, you know, sometimes student debt is characterized as this millennial issue or, you know, a bunch of young people eating too much avocado toast or kind of whatever you might see on social media, but, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. There is now $1.7 trillion of student loan debt. So there's more student loan debt than there are car loans in America. There's more student debt than credit card debt. And nearly 45 million people get a student loan bill each and every month. And, you know, this is truly intergenerational. The fastest growing segment of student loan borrowers are actually older Americans who have seen their ranks quadruple and their balances double just over the last few years. This also isn't just, you know, a big city problem. You see how student debt is impacting small rural communities, impacting family farmers. And the list goes on and on. And I think, you know, what the councilwoman was saying was exactly accurate, that student debt has grown now more than just kind of an individual balance sheet. What is, you know, what is that balance on my student loan bill impacting my life, to really driving larger societal problems in America? So we see how student loan debt impacts everything from small business formation to the, you know, critical frontline jobs we need people to have, especially in the wake of COVID, from frontline healthcare workers to teachers, but then, you know, also impacting larger problems we face in society, from income inequality to racial inequality. And Jalil has really been on the front lines of documenting that. But, you know, that's where we find ourselves, you know, in March of 2021, where the student debt crisis isn't something on the horizon, but something millions and millions of Americans face each and every day.
Yeah. And Jalil, I want to get to you as well. As Seth mentioned, you know, you were recently part of an NAACP report. It looked really closely at how debt disproportionately affects Black students. Just broadly, what are the big takeaways you can tell us?
Thank you. So I think it's important to clarify numbers, because I think in this current debate, we're hearing every day there's a new take, there's a new report, and new numbers being released. And often we assume that because there's a $10,000 proposal on the table, that captures the majority of student loan borrowers, but that really captures about one third of student loan borrowers. So I think it's important to just start out by clarifying that we need to go bigger, just simply thinking about who has student loan debt and how much they're borrowing. Mm-hmm. And when we look at Black borrowers, we know from the research we show in our NAACP report that Black borrowers are much more likely to borrow more, and to have a lower repayment over time. And what that means is that we see from research that Black borrowers, just 4 years after earning their bachelor's, have an average student debt balance that is over $53,000. So way over, that $10,000 balance. And we know that that balance is increasing because Black borrowers are going to grad school really at three times the rate of white bachelor degree earners. And that's important because in my research where, you know, I have survey nearly 1,300 Black borrowers, interview hundreds of Black borrowers, many Black people are reporting to us that they're going to graduate school not because they're increasing incomes or going to graduate school because they're already so well off and they're trying to increase that, but they're going to graduate school because they're experiencing being underpaid and underemployed, and they believe that graduate school is going to give them a boost that we're seeing their non-Black counterparts already experienced just from a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. So while often people are framing graduate school as this indicator that these are well-off borrowers, we know for Black people, and really I would say for people overall, that if you have student debt, you're borrowing that because you lack means, and that the face of someone with a high student debt balance is not a Harvard business school graduate, but it's the social worker who's required to earn that master's in order to participate in their field. It's the teacher who's required to earn that master's in order to participate in their field. And it's the Black borrower who's constantly trying to upskill and up credential to outrun really a discriminatory labor market.
Yeah. Well, and so there's a couple, you know, stats that I think we hear a lot, that Black students are likelier to default on loans, often that they have to borrow more money, like you said. They sometimes end up with lower earnings. One of the things that you have found in your research that I think is really interesting is it also has to do with the schools people go to, and specifically the endowments that those schools have. Can you explain how that works into this?
Yeah. So when speaking of just the differences across institution type, I always try to remind everyone that nuance here is really important. So when we talk about for-profit institutions, we're seeing a lot of predatory and honestly patterned fraudulent behavior, where Black students are being targeted and enrolled in an institutional sector that is more expensive and has a lower return on the credential. At the same time, Black students are going to institutions like HBCUs or public community colleges or regional four-year institutions that really historically and really since the last recession have increasingly been underfunded, meaning that they don't have the endowments or just simply the institutional resources to make sure that they can provide other types of aid beyond relying on students' tuition dollars, which means that they're really relying on students borrowing student loans. So we know that the institutions that enroll our low-income students, our students of color, also are the institutions that historically and currently are underfunded. And that's a piece of this conversation that's not about placing blame on institutions, but acknowledging the history and kind of ongoing reality of higher ed funding.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a bunch of comments coming in here. I want to read two of them because I think they kind of speak to different sides of this discussion that we're having. So this is from Ray. He says, my daughter has student loans and the interest she's being charged is 6.8%. The government should not be charging that much. That gets to this conversation about people not even being able to get on top of their interest and having their balance just growing and growing. And then from Barry on the other side of this, he says he's sympathetic about student debt, but he also feels that people should be making good choices. They should be going to state schools and community colleges. Now, either one of you, Seth or Jalil, I'm wondering if either one of you wants to respond to that.
I'm happy to jump in. I think both are really good questions. So I think, you know, on the first one, you know, I've talked to, you know, thousands and thousands of borrowers over the last decade who have student debt, and the idea of just runaway interest is ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. Just the number of people who every month make a pretty substantial student loan payment only to see their balance continue to rise, never make a dent in principal, and just how demoralizing that is a near constant across the student loan spectrum that I've seen, especially from the people who are struggling. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think gets lost, you know, in the nuance of the debate about canceling student loan debt is just how many people, when we talk about forgiving $10,000 or $50,000, you're literally just talking about cracking into the interest that has accrued while they have faithfully paid their loans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this is something we've heard from the president that he hopes to tackle. And I think one of the things that's important to ensure is that they are tackling this not only on a going forward basis, but we just can't write off the tens of millions of people who've been trapped in the broken system to date. Mm-hmm. And I think on just the second caller very quickly, I think, sure, you know, the one of the things that I have heard just from people over and over again with student debt is, how could this have happened to me when I've done everything that I was supposed to do? I think all of us can remember from, you know, as long as we can remember being told, go to school, take on the debt, it will work out. And tens of millions of people have made that bargain. They have thought that there has been a promise by schools, by their government, by a larger higher education system, that they were making the right decision and there was a path towards, you know, a decent middle class lifestyle at the end. And I think what we see over and over and over again, especially for borrowers of color, is that this promise was broken. This promise was broken years ago when we swapped out the benefits higher education, especially public higher education, with debt-fueled higher education, and all of the risks and were put on the back of individual borrowers. You know, these are people just trying to get a better life for them and their families. You know, I don't, you know, they weren't people buying, you know, fancy cars or big homes. They were just trying to get the benefits of higher education like all of the generations before them, in a system that has rapidly changed and is significantly broken. And I don't think it is too much to try to ensure that those borrowers, you know, get some help and we rectify, you know, the broken promises and the broken system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Jalil, any thoughts on that as well?
Yeah, I have a quick thought.
Yeah.
think, you know, the question around the interest rates is a really important one, because effectively what we have is a student loan system that the government is already spending money to allow people to pay for college. Mm-hmm. It just has been a decision that we're going to allow that money to be loans rather than grants. And for a long time, there was a lot of critique of how the government has used those student loans to turn a profit through interest rates. What we're seeing increasingly as repayment rates have lowered and the cost of administering these loans have increased is that the idea of the government making money is actually starting to shift, that this student loan policy is increasingly becoming costly. And if you think about it at its most basic level, if I pay, you know, $10,000 for my college with a grant or a scholarship, and the next person is paying $10,000 with a loan, and they're likely using that loan because they have less means, they're low income, they're coming from a working class background, that person with the $10,000 loan is the person who's paying more. So what we're effectively asking students to do is those with the less means are those who are being asked to pay the most for higher education. And that's something that we have to always keep in mind when we're thinking about interest rates and how it's a tax in a lot of ways on those who are struggling the most before higher ed, during, and likely to struggle afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
On the question of just the role of state college and people making better choices, I think that we have to really push back against the, I think sometimes the dominant image of who's a college student. A college student is not your 18 to 20-year-old who's going off to their dream college and having this coming-of-age story. The majority of college students are above the age of 24. They're going to a local institution that's probably no more than 50 miles from their home. They're parent students. They're increasingly students of color. They're relying on Pell Grants. So these are the people who are borrowing student loans to pay for their college, but also their living expenses. And when you have someone like Biden in the town hall reference Harvard or Yale as kind of the idea of the person who has student loans, it's a disservice to the everyday working class person who, again, is more likely to be an older student, to be a parent, to be someone who's trying to up their credentials to participate in a changing labor market. And we have to start to shift who we imagine as college students, because they are making local choices. They are going to the community colleges. But these sites also are just too expensive if they're being funded through student loans.
Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of good questions coming in here. I want to get to one from Diane before we have to go to a break in a couple minutes. She says, I totally support helping the disadvantaged get higher education. However, I don't understand why children are allowed to get themselves into such debt that they can't manage. Isn't it up to the lenders to limit debt just as they have with mortgage debt? Isn't it up to the high schools to educate children on how to shop for an affordable college? Shouldn't we look at what colleges can do to reduce the cost? So there's a lot in there, but I want to focus first just on the lender side of it, because I think, you know, Diane's right. Often there's limits on the amount of debt that you can take out, but this is just a situation where people are allowed to take out quite a lot of debt. Seth, do you have any thoughts for Diane on that?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things just to level set is just, you know, how unique the student loan market is,
yeah,
where the federal government is actually the predominant lender and collector for student loans. You know, the federal government owns well over $1 trillion of student loan debt. And despite the fact that most people interact with a private sector company who's like collecting that debt, it's actually the federal government who owns the debt. And I think this is another reason why the ability of the federal government to cancel, you know, some or a significant portion of that debt is readily on the table, is because these aren't loans that have been securitized and sold in Wall Street. You know, there aren't bondholders on the other end. This is literally a decision about the federal government and its balance sheet and how we choose to allocate resources, which makes it a prime and primary opportunity to try to provide some relief for individuals and families who are really struggling. But I wanted to touch on one other piece because, you know, I think that there's this perception, and I think Jaleel touched on this too, that like people are making like the wrong decisions about where they go or how much they're choosing to take on. And I think what you see that is actually happening is for most people, the decision about when about whether they could go to school and afford it that's happening in the financial aid office is binary. It's if you want to go take on an incredible amount of debt, if you're not willing to do that, then you can't afford to go to college. You know, there aren't these, you know, other alternatives which provide this much more like easy path that people are choosing not to take. And I think one of the important things to remind that I always remind myself is, you know, when 45 million people are making a decision, you know, it is not a failure of personal choice. It is a failure of public policy. And this isn't just a bunch of people who have collaborated over the last decade or plus to, you know, indebt themselves or make a whole bunch of poor financial decisions. These are larger public policy failures that drove them to do so. And that's how we have to be thinking about tackling these issues, not kind of tinkering at the edges, whether that's personal finance or individual decision-making about where and when to go to school, but realizing when you've driven tens of millions of people to make the least worst option, that the larger system is the one that needs to be reformed and fixed.
Yeah, yeah. Lots more to talk about this. We have just about 30 seconds left here, but just to kind of tee this up for the next segment, we've got a question from Tony about using bankruptcy court to discharge student debt. I think that's an interesting question to talk about just because, you know, you can't right now. But we are, well, actually, Seth, real quick, just in a couple seconds, is that something that's been discussed?
So it's been discussed. I think, you know, I think it should be on the table. It is certainly not a silver bullet. The people who I talk to don't want to be have to go through bankruptcy to get relief, but it should definitely be discussed in the context of just how punishing the student loan system is for student loan borrowers.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we're talking with Jaleel Mustafa Bishop and Seth Frotman. I'm Katie Meyer in for Marty Moskowain, and we will be back after the break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Katie Meyer. We're talking about student debt with University of Pennsylvania researcher Jaleel Mustafa Bishop and Seth Frotman. He's the executive director of the nonprofit Student Borrower Protection Center. Again, we welcome your questions and comments. We've been getting a lot of good ones. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us, WHYY Radio Times, and our phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Now, I want to get back to the question just we had before the break of discharging student debt, because I think that's, you know, an interesting part of the conversation here. Now, Jaleel, obviously, we know, you know, you cannot declare bankruptcy and get out of your student debt. And so what I think we often have is people who are, you know, defaulting on their loans, people who end up with these unmanageable balances because they can't keep up with interest. You know, where does that part of the conversation come in for you?
So I think for me, first, I grew up in a household where, you know, we filed bankruptcy, and those are real consequences. Mm. Bankruptcy, you know, is a stopgap for someone who's on a free fall. But the process of bankruptcy is really restrictive. It's a lot of restructuring of your debt. It's a lot of extraction of whatever limited income you have coming in. It should never be seen as a go-to solution for people's lives. And no other policy debate have I heard of bankruptcy really being put forth as a solution. But in the student loan debate, that has started to emerge as, well, let's reform bankruptcy law, which we should, but that's something that is a baseline, like should have already been there as it is in other credit markets. So I want to make that clear because bankruptcy is still punitive, even though it's a stopgap for people who are in a free fall. What we need, if we understand student loan debt as a policy failure, is that we really have to talk about the need for debt cancellation. And every proposal that we have really seen, the College for All Act, Debt-Free College Act. They have all called for student debt cancellation that is combined with making college free, if that's tuition free, if that's beyond tuition. But we have to understand that student loan policy is effectively always going to punish people who just have less means. Mm-hmm. And it's going to punish them at when they're borrowing at young ages. It's going to punish them when they're, you know, trying to get ready to retire and can't because they have this balance. So we have to just fundamentally deal with student loan policy for just being a policy that hasn't worked, and the reforms around it for the last 25 years also haven't worked. And start to think about how do we provide education that is a public good, education that is accessible, and doesn't make people choose between, do I go after this opportunity of higher education, or do I leave it alone because I don't want to take on student debt? And that's a really a desperate choice that many people are making. You know, 33% of Parent PLUS borrowers who are Black are from households who actually have a zero expected family contribution for college, meaning that the government has already said you can't afford college, but the only option we're willing to give you to help your children afford is a Parent PLUS loan. So these are families that just already, based on the FAFSA reform, has been marked as not having the means to be able to pay for college. And their only option, which again is a desperate option, is to borrow a Parent PLUS loan with a very high interest rate that they simply can't afford. But again, what are the other options, particularly when you are Black in society, trying to grab all the advantages you can to push back and be a buffer against, again, the historic and ongoing racial barriers.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned just how things have been working. There have been attempts to deal with student debt in the past. This is not a new problem. And Seth, I want to ask you about this. There is an existing program, the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, that started in 2007. What it's supposed to do, it was cancel student people's debt if they worked in public service for 10 years. So that's things like teaching, nursing, being a police officer. You are intimately familiar with this program. A couple years ago, you quit your federal government job over it. What happened?
So, so we've been spending a lot of time, rightfully, talking about the ability to wipe out broad-based debt. So, you know, 10,000, 50,000 more for everybody. But I think something important to remember is that there are all of these programs on the books, public service loan forgiveness included, that Congress has passed. They are law, and they were designed to create like critical safety valves for different segments of borrowers, for different types of situations that should be canceling millions and millions of borrowers' student loans. So one of these is the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, where Congress looked at the ever-rising balances and debt loads and said, we're really worried about what this means for people who we want to serve in our communities and our countries, from service members to teachers to social workers. And the promise was that if you gave back 10 years to your community, you would see your student loan forgiven, wiped out, whatever was left after 10 years of giving back, which is great. Except for the fact that the first group of people are eligible for these programs, and we've seen a 98% denial rate, 98%. And what you have seen is that this like ever increasing Rube Goldberg type structure of forgiveness plans, a combination of incompetence at the student loan industry, nefarious at student loan servicers, and mismanagement by the Department of Ed, has left this problem broken. But it's not only public service loan forgiveness. There's protections for people who went to predatory schools. You see hundreds of thousands of people have their applications for relief denied or sit in limbo. You see borrowers who are totally and permanently disabled who were told that if this happens to you, you'll see your loan forgiven. And despite that promise, continue to get a student loan bill. So one of the things that I really hope that the Biden administration starts tackling in earnest, especially while there is this payment pause, is fixing these broken programs and these broken promises. Because what we see is, honestly, millions and millions of people who get a student loan bill each and every month who should have had their debt wiped out. And I think it's just another reason why people are so skeptical of debt-fueled higher education is because these safety measures, these stopgap measures, which are supposed to be helping people, just haven't worked. And I think people are desperate for them to actually work and provide relief.
Mm-hmm. And you go ahead, Jalil.
I just wanted to jump in because I think it's important to really bottom line this here is that the government already agreed since the 90s that cancellation is a legitimate policy for the student loan issues and now crisis. The problem is that the government just simply has not created a system and process to allow that cancellation to come to pass. So we have, again, just as Seth said, millions of borrowers who are, who should be eligible for cancellation, and we are seeing trivial numbers of applicants actually get that cancellation. So again, cancellation is already on the table. It's already been around for 20 plus years. It just hasn't been used, even though it's been promised to millions of people.
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned, Seth, you mentioned the kind of sort of tangled pile of public and private debt that has been created here. We've got a question from Josh that I think gets to this issue. He says, my wife has accumulated a lot of student debt from grad school. We refinanced with a private company. Will any of the government programs address debt that's refinanced through private companies? Either one of you want to address that?
I could try to jump in quickly.
Sure.
So, you know, I think we, just because of the nature of the size, like spend an enormous amount of time talking about federal student loans, loans the government makes or owns. And I think that is often to a disservice of people who have private student loans. The private student loan market is well over $100 billion. There's more private student loan debt than there's payday loans. There's more private student loans than there is even medical debt in collections. And unfortunately, the private student loan market is really kind of the Wild West when it comes to consumer protections, when it comes to even just basic transparency. And I think this is something that we hope that policymakers really realize. I know there's some efforts in the state of New Jersey for strong consumer protections for private student loan borrowers, where we're hopefully going to see Trenton deliver some relief. But I think to the specific question is, you know, there were some efforts early on in the pandemic led by Chairwoman Maxine Waters to try to provide some pause or some relief for private student loan borrowers. They were unable to get any traction in the Senate. And it's really unfortunate. We've seen student loan companies like Navient and others continue to file debt collection lawsuits in the middle of the pandemic in order to get judgment so they could seize people's wages. And I think we've spent a bunch of time trying to you know, sound the alarm about the real problems that private student loan borrowers face and a real lack of urgency to try to help them.
Mm-hmm. And now going forward, you know, this is a big conversation. We can go on forever. But there for people who are listening to the show right now, maybe who have student debt, what can you tell us about the odds of the U.S. getting some kind of debt relief? Now, just to kind of set it up, so Biden, right now there's a moratorium on most federal student loan payments and interest that goes to September right now. Biden has reviewed the legality of canceling student debt through executive action. The stimulus package had a provision that would have canceled taxation on student loan cancellation through the end of 2025. People saw that as a step towards maybe some cancellation. But Jalil, when you're looking right now at what the federal government's thinking about, what are your expectations?
So first, I think it's to, you know, just make clear to those who are waiting and need this student debt cancellation is that there has been so much movement building where, you know, just 4 years ago, the idea of debt cancellation being on a national stage, having actual policy proposals behind it, is just was a non-thought. So we have made progress. We have done amazing coalition building and advocacy to bring this to the national stage. So there is progress being made. I think the second piece is that we also have a abundance of evidence and strategy around how debt can be canceled. We know that it's legal through executive action because we just watched student debt be paused and interest be really canceled effectively through executive action by the Trump administration and the Biden administration. So the third piece of what are the odds is really about how do we put the political will and increase that political will of Congress in the Biden administration to deliver broad-based, in my case, I argue for full debt cancellation. So I tell people that it's important for you to start to lobby your local and state legislators to start to join coalitions and organizations who are doing this work, such as the Debt Collective or the Student Debt Crisis, which is another org, and start to think about how you can contribute to what is already ongoing and amazing movement building to push for this issue. So I think that there are strong odds that we're going to get some type of debt cancellation. But there's a difference from getting what you can get versus getting what you need. And I think all the evidence shows that what we need is a full debt cancellation, not only to give people relief, but to really transform how we think of higher education, which should be a public good that people don't go into lifetime debt to access.
Mm-hmm. And Seth, I'll ask you the same question. What are your expectations here?
No, I fully agree with the idea of it's remarkable about how fast this conversation has moved. And a lot of that is because of just incredible grassroots organizing, but then also just, you know, real courage and bravery by individuals just telling their story. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been doing this for a while now, and I'm the first to recognize that people sharing how debt is impacting them or financial challenges is really hard. You know, I think it opens you up to attack and criticism. But what has really moved the debate here is individual people willing to share their story about how this debt has impacted their life, has impacted their, larger family and community. And I think in many ways, 2021 and 2022 will be the most consequential years that we see in a very long period of time when it comes to tackling student debt. And I think I was so happy to come on because I think we need more stuff like the councilwoman's resolution in Philadelphia. We need more ways to show that this isn't, you know, just a bunch of people at Harvard or, you know, a bunch of millennials who made bad decisions. And just to talk about how this debt, especially in light of the fallout of the pandemic, is truly an issue that we need to tackle as a society, that this is a civil rights issue, that this is an issue about rebuilding our communities. And so I think the most important thing is finding outlets and ways to share your stories, to talk to your local, state, federal officials about why this is so central towards a much more equitable society. And, you know, I think as the president says, ensuring that, you know, we actually build back better from the crisis.
And then we have just about a minute left, but Jalil, I want to end with you. If any debt is canceled, the underlying system would remain the same. Are there any longer term fixes that reformers like you, like politicians, agree on? And just a couple seconds here.
Yes, I think, again, that there has already been legislation such as Debt-Free College or the College for All Act that has called for debt cancellation that's combined with making college free, if that's just tuition or even beyond tuition. So we are advocating, I'm a member of the Debt Collective, and we are actively working to, and have always been working to have debt cancellation be in combination with free college, which isn't this, you know, pie in the sky idea, but it really is saying we're already paying this money. And right now we're making people repay on a path to nowhere. And the government is also lending money on a path to nowhere, since these loans won't be repaid. And we're saying let's shift our framing of how we pay for college and make it free so that we can actually start to create a system that's accessible. So again, I would say the bottom line here is that we have a failed student loan policy. We have real evidence and strategy of how we can cancel student debt. And increasingly, it will be important for us to remember that in all these policy solutions, we have to center people who are most harmed. We have to have a race conscious focus and just be certain that what we're arguing for here is not just the benefit for individuals, but really what does it look like to build something that's better than what we have today?
All right. Big conversation, but that is all of our time for today. Thank you so much to our guests, Kendra Brooks, Jalil Mustafa Bishop, and Seth Frotman. And thanks to our Radio Times team, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. You can find this episode at WHYY.org shortly. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at WHYY's Radio Times. I am Katie Meyer, sitting in for Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for tuning in.